And nobody had ever dreamt of Patton being able to go over Europe at the rate he did, or of our troops to go through the line at Sampol, the way they finally fought out in the First Army and then virtually surrounded the Germans at the outbreak from the first European entry, the Normandy beachhead. The later moves of the First Army, which was the initial army to move in, were very spectacular. But Patton was moving at such a rate, the attention went to him, and he himself, of course, was very dramatic, and that focused attention on him. But some of the First Army's performances there were magnificent, notably in making the Avranches Gap for Patton to go through. That was made by the First Army. And then the counterattack that Hitler ordered himself, I forget the name of the Kantein or something like that, counterattack, which Bradley chose to, in a sense, ignore, to fight off while he was going ahead with his operations, which he did till they finally surrounded completely quite a section of the German army. And I think that's where General Eisenhower tells afterwards, was seeing a large area where you could step from body to body. All those things were done by the First Army, and then their eventual move out of the sector and wheel to the left, and final battles up on the Belgian border and into the Hindenburg Line. I might tell one thing about General Patton. South of Bar-le-Duc, I guess about 30 miles, was a small town called Gondricourt. That's where I first went to, and was this seat of division, first division schools, and the corps schools afterwards, officer schools. And I lived with a very interesting landlady. She was a very amusing woman, ran a wonderful mess for me, and I had three other fellows in it, one of which was Jean Hugo. And we had a very relaxing time in that mess. It saved me from the terrific strain we were going through in our other situations at that time. So Madame Zwart became very much endeared to me, and I to her, I think. I stayed there 6 months, and I had a little tiny room with a sort of a Napoleonic-looking bed, and she looked after me in every way she could. And when I left there, she kept in touch with me all the time, though I didn't see her again. And she wrote to me, first used to write to me each season, winter, summer, fall, and spring, and then she got so she'd write twice a year. Her boy had been a prisoner in the woods that I'd gone through with the Foreign Legion when recaptured it. And I brought some of the things back from that woods, machine guns and things, which I gave to her, and which she treasured very highly. Then this next war came, and of course she couldn't write to me after that because she was in the occupied zone. And finally, Patton's troops drove through there and into the vicinity of Metz. So I sent him a message and told him if I thought Gondricourt was in his rear zone, that is, a zone he'd be responsible for, and if he got down there on one of his inspections, to look up my dear friend Madame Zouat, J-O-U-A-T-T-E, on 2 Rue Sorcy, S-O-R-C-Y. And the next I heard of it, he sent me the photographs and a description by a staff officer. Patton arrived there with 5,000 armored troops, 2 revolvers on, a whole truckload of supplies for Madame Zouat. The town turned out in fear and trembling. The mayor and the town council, whatever they call it, came to him trembling, and Patton growled at them in his best rough French, "Where is Madame Zouat?" Well, they'd never heard of Madame Zouat. And he turned over to her a whole truckload of supplies, enough to last her family a long, long time, and made it quite an impression in Gondricourt, the importance of Madame Zouat. I came along while I was Secretary of State and was at the United Nations. And on one weekend, I went to Metz, went over the northernmost Meuse-Argonne battlefields, and came on down through Tours, T-O-U-R-S, and Gondricourt. I had my aide go ahead of me in another car and find out if Madame Joat was there, but not tell her that I was there. I was coming. And when I got there, he told me that she had moved, and she was at such a place in the main square of the town. So we drove there, and Mrs. Marshall didn't get out of the car, and I told her to stay in a second. I wanted to go up, surprise Madame Joat. But the square was pretty full of people going to church. The church bells were ringing. It was a peaceful Sunday. But the fact of these two limousines there in the courtyard attracted all their attention. And when I got out of them, they all stopped and stared. And then Madame Joat's curiosity had been aroused. She came out of her doorway in an old wrapper and in carpet slippers. And she wasn't a very dressy old lady anyway, and she looked pretty slack in these clothes. But she was unchanged otherwise. And she came out, and I'd crossed about half the distance when she looked up and recognized me. And she dashed at me and threw her arms around my neck and kissed me on both cheeks. So I embraced her, and I kissed her, and we had a great scene out there with all the people in the square cheering. And then Ms. Marshall got out and came out, and we went into the house, and we'd gotten some things for her at Nancy, which Mrs. Marshall gave to her, and a present of something, I've forgotten what, something like a waiter and a tray and things to go on. I don't remember what it was. But anyway, her excitement was intense, and it was a very joyful occasion, and I got great satisfaction out of it, and Mrs. Marshall particular satisfaction out of it. And as we were driving off, we had to hurry to get back to Paris. Mrs. Marshall began peeling out of her only fur coat. We'd gotten down the street about a block. I said, "What are you doing?" She says, "I'm going to give this to Madame Joat." I said, "No, you're not. I haven't got enough money to buy you another one. You'll have to keep that." And I wouldn't let her give it to Madame Joat. I was sorry afterwards I did it, but the fact was I didn't have enough money to do that. I went through the war when my responsibilities ran up to 8.5, almost 10 million troops, and 9 fighting sectors. My salary was $10,000 a year, and I spent all my savings, and that didn't meet my bills, and I had a very, very hard time. All the time I was chief of staff, and then when I was secretary of state, all I got was $15,000 a year.